This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A standing joke in the Washington Post newsroom is that people get nervous when they see Howard Kurtz coming with pen and pad. Kurtz is the Post's media critic and is sometimes in the awkward position of reporting on the work of his colleagues at the Post. He says he tries to hold journalists accountable to the same standards they hold politicians to. Kurtz has written a new book called Media Circus, which he describes as his attempt to examine what has gone wrong with the profession he loves. Kurtz learned how hard it can be to report on your own paper when he wrote about Post reporter Juan Williams. Williams had written an op-ed piece in the paper supporting Clarence Thomas, saying there was no credible evidence for Anita Hill's allegations. Kurtz learned that Williams himself had been accused of sexual harassment.
That was probably the most difficult episode I've ever had to handle in my job as the media critic. But there really was very little choice because it was such a supercharged atmosphere because of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And Juan Williams had gotten so much attention for defending Clarence Thomas against the sexual harassment charges. I got into it very simply because a couple of women in the newsroom called me and said, you ought to know that there's an inquiry going on involving Juan Williams. I quickly determined that this had to be news, that this would be news if it was happening in any other newspaper, wanted to write about it, was initially stopped by my bosses from writing about it for the very simple reason that they felt there was a confidential personnel process going on. Juan Williams was entitled to his day in court, so to speak. I argued, unsuccessfully at first, that this was going to come out, that other people were going to write about it and broadcast it, and the Post may as well get into it and let everybody have their say. Once a local television station did report the news that there was this inquiry going on, I did finally got, this is 2 or 3 days later, I got the green light to go ahead and write it, and I reflected the point of view of the editors, Juan Williams' feelings, and everybody else who had a hand in this story. It was a very tense time in the newsroom, and there was really no way to avoid the subject.
But you had to wait till somebody else broke the story, and then you were able to write about it?
That is the only time that has happened, and I don't know what would have happened had a local television station not written it first. I mean, I have a feeling that sooner or later the editors of the Post would have decided, uncomfortable as it made everybody feel, that this was news, that we had become part of the story, that one of our most prominent writers, like it or not, was now part of the Clarence Thomas story. But in this particular instance, the fact that somebody else went first, and things often work like this in the news business, when somebody pops a story, when somebody puts it in play, that gives you the opportunity to jump into it without a heck of a lot more thought.
Let's talk a little bit about the White House and the Clinton administration. President Clinton just replaced George Stephanopoulos with David Gergen. What does that say to you?
It says to me that Clinton realizes that he has a problem with the press. I mean, obviously, there are many levels here. There's also Clinton trying to move a little bit toward the center and correct what some see as the leftward drift of his administration. But from a press perspective, you know, there was a lot of talk after what I call the talk show campaign, the campaign of last year that relied so heavily on Larry King and Arsenio and MTV, that the traditional press didn't matter anymore, that a president could just simply go around the Beltway press corps, go on talk shows, do satellite interviews with local anchors, and basically the heck with people like me who like to ask adversarial questions. I think there's a recognition here that Clinton's been hurt by that, like it or not, and sometimes I think the Beltway press corps is too self-absorbed and too prosecutorial, but they're there and they're going to be a major filter between any president, any politician, and the American people. And so I think the president recognizes that he perhaps needs to do a little better job of getting his message out to the people who, not just print reporters, but network types who cover him every day and maybe have a few less stories about $200 haircuts.
What was George Stephanopoulos' reputation among the reporters that covered the White House?
Most reporters like George Stephanopoulos. They think he's a very straight shooter. They thought he was a very sure hand during the campaign. There was a little bit of a feeling that perhaps he was overloaded, that from a strategic point of view, perhaps he was not doing as well or the administration was not doing as well as it might. But basically, reporters trusted Stephanopoulos, although he could be very frustrating at briefings because he's developed about 4,000 ways of not saying anything when we demand to know what it is the president's going to do tomorrow or next week.
I just judging him from the sitting at home watching C-SPAN angle, yeah. He was kind of boring at the briefings. I mean, when he would tell you nothing, he wouldn't tell you nothing with flair.
Right, it's the spokesman's job to tell you nothing, but to make you like it.
And to have a sense of irony
could be a
about
on
it.
A dull
or something.
Side.
Yeah, right.
Dee Dee Myers, I think, does it with a little more humor, and we'll probably see more of her at these daily briefings.
No, is that important? Does that matter?
It matters in a sort of an indirect sense. I mean, it matter. You know, initially the Clinton White House tried to televise these briefings, and what they got was, 30 minutes a day of reporters and Stephanopoulos shouting at each other, and they quickly pulled the plug on that. It matters in the sense that if the White House press corps feels like it's getting stiffed, if it feels like it's not getting information, if it feels like the spokesmen are basically blowing them off, I think that attitude then creeps its way into the copy. Many reporters would deny this, but I think that to the extent that there has been these underlying tensions between the White House press corps and the administration, and most notably over this travel office story, which after all was about the press's perks and the press's travel, it has an effect. We're probably less inclined to give a president the benefit of the doubt. And so in that sense, I don't think that he necessarily needs to cater to us, and there are still ways that he can go around us and take his message over our heads. But it probably just makes good political sense for the president to have a better relationship with the White House press corps.
You recently had an article about how Hillary Clinton was handling interview requests. And she was asking a lot of people to submit questions to see what they wanted to talk about. Do you think that's a legitimate thing for a politician or a first lady to do? And would you have interviewed her if it required submitting questions in advance?
Personally, I would not. I don't think she's the first political figure to do this, but I don't think that necessarily that we have to play along. I mean, it's perfectly fine for the first lady or the president or anybody else to try to set conditions on interviews, to try to say, well, I'm only going to talk about this or that. Generally, though, when it's a president or a senator or a governor, reporters will get on the high horse and say, well, we're not going to play that game. We want the right to come in here and ask anything that we want. In Hillary's case, in Hillary Clinton's case, you know, she is the first lady, and first lady has generally been treated differently. This first lady, obviously, is both the traditional hostess person and a player, an important player in lots of meetings on healthcare and other subjects in the White House. Secondly, though, she's been so in demand. There's so many magazines in particular that want to put her on the cover that I think she's been more able than perhaps even her husband to call the shots, to say that I'm not going to talk to certain publications, to want to screen questions in advance.
You say that most White House reporting is mediocre. What's the problem?
Part of the problem is that there are too many of us doing it. I mean, I just think that the White House beat has become a parody of PAC journalism. I mean, dozens and dozens of reporters, excellent reporters from great news organizations who follow the president around the world and record his every burp. I don't think we need that many people performing what's essentially a transcription function. It's certainly not the reporters. They tend to be some of the best reporters in town. I just think we overcover the president because, after all, as you mentioned earlier, in the age of C-SPAN, wire services, you can now get transcripts of presidential statements on computer maybe an hour after the president has spoken. How much do we bring to it? I mean, we have very little access to the president. In fact, we have very little access to most administration officials. We were trapped in that press room, particularly when you're on the road. These guys control your every movement. And yet at the same time, while everybody is covering the supposedly glamorous beat of what did the president say today, we do a hell of a lot worse job covering the federal bureaucracy, covering regulatory agencies, covering less sexy parts of the government where a lot of the real work of governing gets done. So I just think that I just think that it's a sort of a celebrity approach to political coverage because the president is the celebrity in chief, but that most of the stories tend to be repetitive.
Funny.
They
That's...
tend to sort of say the same thing.
Celebrity in chief. That's good.
I like it myself.
Do you think that Clinton's recent haircut and the travel agency story, do you think they were overplayed?
My initial feeling on the travel agency story was that it was a bit overblown, that the average person in Peoria didn't care as much as reporters. But I've since revised that view. I mean, now that we've learned more about how the administration bungled it, called in the FBI improperly, tried to install Clinton's cousin as the new head of the travel office, that seems to me to be a pretty blatant political misuse, or at least there's lots of evidence to that effect. And so I think that is an important story. The haircut is one of the classic stories that the press is always going to go wild over. Is it real important in the larger context? No, but it is a symbol, and we love symbols. And, you know, the idea of Bill Clinton sitting there on the runway at LAX getting a haircut from a guy with one name did seem to raise certain questions about the populist image that he preferred to project. And so, sure, we overplayed it a little bit, but I don't find too much fault with us for that.
Howard, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. My guest is Howard Kurtz, and he reports on the media for The Washington Post. He's the author of the new book, Media Circus. This is Fresh Air. Howard Kurtz is my guest, author of the new book, Media Circus. How would you write in your book about one of the really difficult choices you had to make about the issue of disclosure? You were going to write about the Pentagon, the high-placed Pentagon official who was about to be outed by a gay magazine, and you were trying to decide whether you should use his name or just go with the high-placed Pentagon official. This is a particularly interesting story for me because I just interviewed Michelangelo Signorelli a couple of weeks ago, who's like Mr. Outer.
Absolutely. That's his claim to fame.
That's what he does. And so here it is, like 2 years after the story broke, and I'm still sitting here wondering, well, should I say a high-placed Pentagon official, or should I go with that Pentagon official's name? And the dilemma was for me was, okay, it's 2 years after the fact. At least half the people listening are going to know this person's name because it's been reported in a lot of places. On the other hand, if you don't really want to go along with outing, you still feel like you're participating in it by giving the name.
You've put your finger on the dilemma precisely.
Yeah. So tell me how you handled it. What was in your like list of reasons to give the name and list of reasons not to give the name?
All right, well, let me just clarify, because I never considered writing a story that named this particular official. To me, the question was, should I write about the outing phenomenon? And should I write about the fact that there was this effort by gay activists to use a Pentagon official as a symbol of, in their view, hypocrisy, which is to say the Pentagon's policy of discharging gay soldiers and not giving security clearances. The debate at the Washington Post was never got to the point of should we name this person. It was simply should we even write a story about the process going on, and ultimately the editors decided not to. My feeling was this, and it's a dilemma we confront lots of different kinds of stories involving people's personal lives. On the one hand, I think outing is despicable. I think it's basically kind of a terrorist tactic in which people try to use the media, and sometimes the media allow themselves to be used, in order to score political points at the expense of somebody's privacy. This particular person had never defended the Pentagon's anti-gay policies. He was simply an employee, an important employee, to be sure. So I didn't quite see the hypocrisy argument that some were making. On the other hand, at the time that I was working on this, Jack Anderson had written a column which was syndicated to 600 newspapers naming the person. A New York TV station had to use the person's name. The Advocate, which is a gay magazine based in Los Angeles, had used the person's name. And I was wondering when this was going to reach a critical mass where basically everybody would know who we were talking about. And so it seemed to me that I ought to write about what was going on because it was an important political effort, although I did not want to be in the position of going along by naming this person, and ultimately we didn't.
It was interesting to me that even in your book, which just came out, you don't name this person.
Well, it seems to me that all the same arguments are still there. I mean, this person is still publicly known. This person still doesn't want his private life discussed. And I don't see, I mean, it seems to me there's even less reason now that this person is no longer at the Pentagon because the Bush administration is no longer in power to just for sort of titillation value, it's so-and-so. And so I'm going to stick to not naming him. Obviously, we're in the ridiculous position where lots of people know the name.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the same debate that went on in the William Kennedy Smith case where the naming of the woman who has since gone public, Patty Bowman, who had accused Smith of rape, just sort of spread up the media food chain and everybody used somebody else as a justification. You know, the NBC broadcast the name because the supermarket tabloid in Florida had printed it, and then the New York Times used the name because NBC had broadcast it. And I think the New York Times now regrets that and concedes that was not a wise decision. So to some extent, if you simply take the approach that, well, somebody else did it there, I'm going to do it, and this often comes up when rumors find their way into print, you've essentially abdicated your news judgment. You're letting someone else set your standards. At the same time, I'm the first to say that whether it's a Jennifer Flowers or some story like that, when a story does reach critical mass and it is all over the airwaves, you can't just stick your head in the sand and pretend that your readers don't know about it. So it's a very delicate tightrope to walk.
I'm told that a lot of reporters knew that this high-placed Pentagon official was gay. Do you think that they should have reported it? If they knew that?
I guess I'm still not sure why it was news. Sure, lots of people knew. I think it was kind of an open secret. But unless, you know, the only argument for it is that, as is sometimes charged against conservative members of Congress who are actively anti-gay, and yet if, you know, someone like Robert Bauman, who then turns out to be homosexual himself, is that the person is guilty of personal hypocrisy, that they're taking a public stance that is completely at variance with their personal life. Then it seems to me there's an argument that it's news. In this case, this person happened to be a high official of the Pentagon, but I didn't see any evidence that he was publicly espousing an anti-gay line. People basically wanted to use him to get at the Pentagon, whose policies they didn't like. So, no, although I think sometimes we're in the position of keeping secrets for people that we shouldn't, and that we shouldn't be so cozy with politicians, for example, that we don't tell you things that are newsworthy. I guess I'm still not convinced that this particular matter was newsworthy.
Well, let's look at another issue that had to do with disclosure, personal disclosure, and I'm thinking about Arthur Ashe's disclosure that he had AIDS, and he made that public disclosure after he found out that his condition was about to be reported in the press. Now, you write that you're troubled by the conspiracy of silence over his disease, that a lot of reporters knew him and knew that he had AIDS, but had decided to keep that confidential. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think by any definition, Arthur Ashe is a public figure, and not famous, you know, world famous not only as a tennis player, but as a columnist, as a network commentator, as an activist, and so forth. And here we're not talking about reporting on somebody's sex life. We're talking about a life-threatening condition that did indeed, within a year, take Arthur Ashe's life. I guess, you know, and then suddenly it does come out because of an inquiry by USA Today. And we hear of all these sports writers who says, oh, yeah, I knew, but I wasn't going to tell anybody. I wonder if they would have had the same attitude had it been, for example, a life-threatening heart condition. There's something about AIDS because of the question of how it's contracted where we seem to put it in some kind of special privacy zone. And I'm not for just invading anybody's privacy anytime we feel like it, but it seems to me that Arthur Ashe being ill with a life-threatening disease, whether it's AIDS or something else, is clearly news. And those sports writers who didn't feel they needed to report it were really telling the public, this guy is my friend, and the friendship is more important than my journalistic responsibility. So it troubled me. On the other hand, I understand their position.
But, I mean, he wasn't in elected office where
our
and that's political exactly future is in his hands or anything.
Of a company. He was not running for public office, and therefore there should be a different standard. And I would agree. It's, you know, it's not even a close call if it's somebody who is a senator or a presidential candidate. But, you know, it also obviously was going to come out at some point. And I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, would I have reported had I known? Would I have reported against his will had he asked me not to report it? He didn't want his little girl to know. I don't know. That's one of those journalistic dilemmas that's very, very difficult to solve.
I want to ask you about when something is news and when something is gossip. And you give a very kind of interesting example of this in your book. You got information from a source that Dan Quayle, and this was during the whole Murphy Brown period, was renting his Virginia home to an unwed couple who was living with the wife's two children from a previous marriage. And you thought that this was relevant and should be printed as news. Why did you think it should be printed as news, and why did it end up on the gossip page?
Well, it ended up on the gossip page of the Washington Post and then on the front page of a lot of other newspapers because of the political context at the time. Because, Dan, this was the Murphy Brown period. This was when the vice president was going around the country, you know, criticizing the fictional Murphy Brown character as an unwed mother and talking about unwed mothers and sort of setting himself up as a moralistic authority on this subject. And suddenly, although there was some question about whether he knew about it, we learned that he was renting out his home to an unwed couple. So it seemed like there was a question of hypocrisy, that he wasn't applying the same standards in his personal life as he was on the stump. And often gossip does become news. The famous $200 haircut also happened to originate in the gossip column of the Washington Post, and that's been one of the biggest stories of recent weeks. I basically think that we do too much gossip in the sense that stuff that we know isn't true, or we aren't sure that if it's true. And the haircut, whether you think it was an important story or not, had some factual basis. He was there sitting on the runway getting his locks trimmed by Kristoff. But to take another example, a few weeks ago, every reporter in Washington had heard this rumor, supposedly from the Secret Service, that Hillary Clinton had thrown a lamp or other large object at her husband during some kind of fight in the White House. Nobody knew whether it was true. And I don't think that sort of thing should be printed. Newsweek put it in play by printing it on its gossip page, and then other people picked it up and sort of printed it with a wink and a nod. And now it's become part of the general discourse. And that kind of thing, you know, unless you can nail it down, unless you've got an eyewitness, unless you've got a real source, just seems to me we are playing the role of gossip monger when we report that sort of thing.
But I guess there's this attitude that once one big paper has it, then you have to mention it too.
Right, and this is one of the most corrosive things, I think, in the news business, is that we are all involved in what Jerry Nachman, the former editor of the New York Post, once told me was a great race to be first, to be second. In other words, we're all dying to report this stuff because we know people are going to find it fascinating. But since we don't really have it nailed down, we'll just wait till somebody else goes. And then that gives you an excuse to get into print. You can even do it as a media story. Look at what those tabloids are up to now. And I think we need to practice a little more restraint, because there is a difference between an item being in a gossip column, an unsubstantiated item, and everybody putting it at the top of their broadcasts or on a prominent page in the newspapers. But that distinction has been lost in recent years.
As a watchdog person, yes. Someone whose job is to watch over the press, I'm wondering if you feel that you were ever misquoted or unfairly treated in the press yourself. If you've ever been the subject of press coverage, I don't know if you have.
Yeah, occasionally I have, sure. Especially since I've taken on this job, I've been interviewed a lot. I have had instances where reporters have, they have a preconceived notion of the story, and they're constantly trying to get me to say the thing that's going to make their point for them, even if I obviously don't agree or if I have reservations. Sometimes that gives me less than full confidence in my colleagues. But I've also had some good experiences where, you know, I've been interviewed on a complicated subject, and the gist of what I said came across loud and clear. So it has taught me that the press is not a monolith, that some people do a good job, some people do a less than perfect job, and that it's not easy being... It's a lot easier to ask the questions than it is to be the one who answers them.
Has it affected how you quote people?
I think as both a combination of that and just complaints that people have registered over the years as I've become a little older and hopefully marginally wiser, I've tried not to fall into the temptation of just using the most inflammatory quote. That, in other words, if a person says 9 nice things about Bill Clinton and 1 real zinger, it's fine to use the zinger, but you ought to also indicate that, you know, in the course of an interview in which he generally said the president was doing a good job, he said blah, blah, blah. I think I've become more sensitive to that because it's so easy to go the other way. It's so easy to just sort of use people's words in a way that they don't intend. And so... hopefully, I'm learning to do that a little better.
Howard Kurtz, thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed being here.
Howard Kurtz is media critic for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Media Circus. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.